going to talk about, for a while, the weather wars. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, Bill.
How are you?
Oh, fine.
Is the weather still being manipulated a bit?
Yes, it is.
Give us an update, if you don't mind. And what we were talking about. You know, I just said the weather wars were manipulating the weather. Who's manipulating the weather, and what are they doing, and how are they doing it?
Well, of course, the Soviet Union has been manipulating the weather over the U.S. for some time. I realize that lots of our listeners have heard other broadcasts we've made, so I don't want to go too deeply into how they do it. I'll just say that the different kind of electromagnetics they use attached to the signals that come from the woodpecker transmitters, which are sort of like a big over-the-horizon radar and intersect with the United States. They use that intersection grid to create high-pressure areas and low-pressure areas and then move those areas around at will and divert the jet streams. That's the primary mechanism they use. And so by diverting the jet streams, they can give you cold weather further south, or they can turn the winds and the clouds and cause them to swirl and give you violent thunderstorms and tornadoes and everything else. And so right now in the southeast, they seem to be giving us a very bad drought. So that's the current situation, is they are keeping the circulations so that we don't get much moisture down the southeast. And the drought is really, really hurting the farmers. Unless we get more rain than we've gotten in this spring, a lot of farmers in the southeast are going to go belly up. It's really serious for many of them.
Well, Thomas, the last time we talked, and I, on this particular project of the Soviet Union, and those that are trying to discern what they're doing, we looked at the enormously anomalous weather of winter before last. Did we see that repeated this last winter?
Well, this last winter, we had some anomalies, but not such serious anomalies as we had then. Apparently, they were using the grids for other purposes besides primarily the weather. I really don't want to talk about those other purposes on the show tonight, because I'll have a book coming out in about 3 weeks where I cover that in great detail.
I understand.
And so, really, I'd like to... In fact, I really would like to divert that subject for a later time.
All right.
So they didn't give us the anomalies in the winter that we've come to expect in the previous winters. They gave us some real anomalies, which if you get the book, you'll see. But they have done some of it, and the biggest thing they have going this spring has been to zero in on us with this drought. This appears to be a determined effort to really cause some damage to the agriculture of the United States. And we've seen something different in this particular weather engineering. They seem to be using a bit more action in the earth itself as opposed to in the clouds. In other words, potentials, you know, you need 2 points, and it's the difference between them. You can either make that point up in the clouds or you can make it in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are doing an additional little component, or it's not a little one, a pretty good sized one, in the southeast, in changing some of the scalar potentials of the earth itself. We have a person at the present time who I'd rather not name, who's involved in trying to do something about that. We'll have to wait and see whether that's going to be successful or not, but he's doing what he can.
Yeah, there is a lot of work being done in this area, Tom. You and I can sit here and talk in very ominous terms, but there is work being done in the United States to counter this.
Yes, of course, I have to laugh, and I'm not laughing because it's funny. The problem is that it would be nice if it were being done by officialdom with well-funded efforts and, you know, teams of scientists and things like that.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that's not the case. It's done by lone inventors struggling in their backyards and in their garage laboratories and so forth with little or no funding. That's the real problem in this area at the present time.
Well, we have a problem with officialdom, because officialdom means a bureaucrat, whether he is civilian or military. And his first function is to never make a decision, number one. And his second function then is to check a book somewhere. And if it's not done, if it's not in there, then good, he's done his job and it goes out the window.
Well, as you know, the real problem in the whole thing, whether we're talking weather engineering or the Soviet development of weapons, or whether we're talking the struggle to get free energy in this country or cheap energy widely available for everybody, the real problem is the fact that we have crystallized what we consider to be the basis for science. And we have, essentially, in official science, we don't think that there's any new basis to be discovered. And we think we've got the perfect basis already established in what we teach in university. And, of course, that's the problem. It's just simply not true.
Well, I remember the head of the patent office in 1901 wanted to shut down the patent office because he said all things that have could possibly be invented have been invented. And he made that appeal to Congress, if you remember.
Well, that's true, and in fact, there are many, many such incidents. 2 years after the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk, the publication Scientific American was still publishing learned papers proving conclusively that heavier-than-air machines could not fly. And Goddard, when he was out in the New Mexico desert, experimenting with rockets and building gyro-stabilized platforms in them for the first time and things like this, really pioneering rocketry in this country and in much of the world, Goddard was regarded as a lunatic playing with Chinese firecrackers, and in fact he had made one statement that someday man would be able to use these rockets to go to the moon. And in the Pentagon and...
How dare him say something like that?
Beg your pardon?
I said, how dare him say something foolish like that?
Well, it earned him a nickname. In the Pentagon, he was referred to widely as Moon Mad Goddard.
Yeah.
And everybody would fall out of the chair laughing. Now, we laughed out of the other side of our mouth, of course, when the Germans started firing V-1s and then later V-2s at us.
They have quite a monument to Mr. Goddard now.
Well, now he's the accepted thing, as if that never occurred, you know, as if science had never ignored him. But in fact, he was ostracized by conventional science and considered rather much of a madman or a lunatic that had got in the hot sun in the desert too much.
Do we see a problem here in the United States of if it's not invented in the United States, it does not exist?
For a long time, it's been very fashionable in American science to consider... I would say that they would consider the Soviets were really a bunch of ignorant peasants still trying to clean the mud off their boots. And, of course, that's far from the truth. The Soviets have always led the whole world in nonlinear mathematics and nonlinear aspects of science. They've always been great in nonlinear calculations and nonlinear theory since the very beginning.
Well, we now have a problem. It looks like, Tom, that a science has been thrown upon us, which you and I talked about before, and with your help, I wrote an article on in Let's Talk magazine, which, with your help, kind of explained it in a very simplistic way. That there is a science. It's an energy at a distance science that allows the Soviet Union to energize areas of our atmosphere, bend the jet streams, 90 degrees quite often, dramatically alter our weather, do great havoc to our agriculture and to our people, in fact. These weather storms that we had last year and the year before, there were many deaths involved. The data is in that this is not Mother Nature doing that. Is anybody listening to the science?
I think behind the scenes they are. They're certainly not saying that openly yet, but I think they realize, many of them realize, that the weather has just been far too anomalous for it to occur by statistical accident. For example, the standard kind of estimate of how anomalous has the last decade been shows that you could expect that from nature only once in some 1,200 or so years, and unless you've just had a real fluke of nature here, something has been happening to us in the last decade. And, of course, that's the decade that since we've had the Soviet woodpecker signals turned upon us.
I was, we touched upon it before the last June 29th. It's just one of those very unusual things that happens to a person, but I took some videotape.
Yes, indeed.
And I don't think that nature fills the sky with square clouds.
Not when it's a knife edge square, and you did get a good picture. And I'm very glad you did, because, you know, as you know, we included it with your permission in our videotape explaining exactly how they do engineer the weather.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, that has occurred more often than people would think, but it always occurs, you know, when the person hasn't got a camera or something like that. And so to get one on video was really a good stroke of fortune. We have seen an awful lot of grids in and around other incidents that have been different uses of that same grid. Some of that, for example, will be described in the new book. Some of it has been seen right there in California by, for example, engineer Ron Cole, and that's documented. We've seen some grids down here, though not the classic grid like you took with your camera there. We've only seen the residue after the winds have been chopping at it for a while. But they have been still using the grid with a very high degree of activity, almost on a, how shall we say it, when you get everything reduced to just standard operations, just on a standard operating procedure. And I think we're going to see probably a little more of the weather control now, as they seem to be toning down a little bit, hopefully, some of these other activities. Unfortunately, I think that they are going to continue to try to influence this drought, and whether or not the individuals trying to do something about that succeed or not is yet to be seen.
I think we sent you some other photographs from a listener of this show who took some of the most amazing pictures I have ever seen of a cloud formation out over Santa Monica Bay, actually.
That's the Al Matthews pictures.
The Al Matthews pictures.
Yes, they were a series of bars, almost like a draftsman had gotten up in the sky and drawn them there.
Perfectly laid out.
Nature normally doesn't make very perfect straight-edged bars like that. Normal wave clouds, of course, do widely occur and are well-known, but they certainly do not look like that. Those were not wave clouds of the normal kind at all.
I thought the timing of that cloud was very important.
Yes, indeed, and, of course, that's edging towards a subject I really don't want to talk about tonight.
All right. I'm with you on that one.
All I'll say is they have been using the grid in a weapons mode. Get the new book. I'll tell you all about it. There are some contributions in that book from some of the other researchers like Don Dabini and Frank Golden. And we've done our best to describe what's going on over your head.
Well, I have a surprise for you. In the studio for me, or with me right now, is Mr. John Dabini.
Fantastic.
Hello, John. Welcome to Open Mind.
How do you do, Bill? How are you, Tom?
How are you doing, John?
Fine. How are you?
Well, it's pretty good weather out here. A little hot, but still pretty good.
John has been very, very involved with Tom in the this research and a lot of other researches, too, and can give some expertise to some of the questions that may come up, because we do want to talk about our weather wars update. The weather wars that we talked about has continued on, as you've listened to Tom. And, of course, then John has a lot of updating for you, too, on some of the fascinating world of the land of Bedini.
Yes, indeed. I'm very much interested in that, Bill, because I think John has, you know, from our discussions we've had recently, John has been doing some very, very interesting work indeed, and particularly in the thing he's calling optophonics. That's extremely important.
Well, I think it's probably one of the most exciting things that's happened. Here I am in the radio industry. But I'm also a person who sits at home and listens to my radio and my hi-fi and all of that. But the science involved in order to bring you another step in sound that is more important than the step that optophonics is to stereo is more important than what stereo was to monaural, right? And in a strange kind of way, and I hate to be mystic here, but we can't talk about a lot of the reasons that those things all interrelate to weather wars.
I think we can tell them.
They do.
I think we can tell them that John is, as everybody knows, if I might use the term, a scalar engineer, because he is doing scalar electromagnetic engineering of the most basic kind that you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
and the most fundamental kind. I think we can certainly point out that he's applied some of this extensive knowledge he's gained over the years, he's applied that in the optophonics, and it certainly shows.
What I want to do, Tom, is take a little break here. I know the callers are beginning to line up to talk to you. We want to go over the Weather Wars thing as much as we can, because it is and has been for some time a serious problem. There have been a lot of questions that have been asked of me since your last appearance talking about it and the article you and I wrote in Let's Talk Magazine. And give the folks a chance to go, you know, nose to nose with you, if we may, because I don't pretend to know how to answer these questions.
Okay.
I can say the words that you have taught me to say. I can't say that I know exactly what they mean.
Okay, well,
have a go ahead. All right. Let me give the numbers. If you'd like to talk to Tom Bearden tonight about a new kind of science that is being employed against us, all of the data seems to suggest that. Let me give you the numbers. In Los Angeles, talk about the weather wars for a lot. We have a lot of things to talk about tonight with John and Tom. But William is on the line. Hi, William.
Hello.
Hey.
I had a question, a comment. I'm wondering about the possibility, he may not want to talk too much about this, but he might be able to confirm it. Each particular element in nature has a resonance vibration. And using this, what did they call it, fibrosonics? What did he call it?
Optophonics.
Optophonics. Could it be possible, for instance, to change or disable the reactions, say, in a nuclear device?
Let me answer that fairly briefly by saying you have two kinds of resonance. You have the normal electromagnetic resonance we all think about, and of course, in physical matter, we have things like sound resonance and other kinds like that.
Correct.
But by and large, in space-time itself, in the actual space-time that a piece of matter or something occupies, you have a scalar resonance, or it's really a purely gravitational resonance. It consists usually of a group of frequencies, rather much like a Fourier expansion. Any kind of physical process or any kind of physical device in its operational form and in its operation has key resonances like that in the gravitational area. Now, since we don't do any kind of gravitational engineering in orthodox science, they don't measure anything like that at all. They don't even have a gravitational detector that'll do that. But you can use the scalar electromagnetics, which is purely electrogravitation, and you can measure and detect those kinds of frequencies and those kinds of patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you hit or augment those frequencies with scalar electromagnetics, you are now augmenting the frequency or the amplitude of each wave in a gravitational manner, and you can damage or blow up or destroy any kind of thing like that. Also, the basic mechanism for the most deadly danger of nuclear material, that really the danger was originally pointed out by Reich in his experiments with orgone energy, which was scalar electromagnetics. Nuclear material is particularly susceptible to this kind of effect. And the reason is condensed matter already has a gravitational potential with reference to the vacuum around it. And so in condensed matter, if the nucleus is unbalanced, there are resonances trying to break up inside the nucleus in that potential that's already up above the ground. In other words, as you can see, you have an unstable situation. It's sort of like something vibrating on the edge of a big cliff. If it ever reaches the edge of the cliff, it's going to fall off, and the nucleus then would decay. If you hit that nucleus with a sharp rise in potential, now, this is electrogravitational potential. That nucleus will immediately go bananas. It will immediately decay in most cases. Certainly, if you have radioactive material, you will have a very large surge in decay immediately. And anything nuclear, when the electrogravitational pulses, scalar electromagnetic pulses, are being bandied about, anything nuclear presents a very deadly danger. If anything nuclear gets one of those pulses, it's a pretty big pulse. All the little radioactive nuclei are going to go full nuclear or almost full nuclear right away and decay. And you're going to get an extreme burst of radioactivity. It doesn't matter if it's a nuclear warhead in storage, in a missile, or if it's a nuclear reactor. And so all the nuclear facilities on the face of the Earth today represent really extreme danger to the whole human species from the use of scalar electromagnetic weapons, as evidenced by the Soviet Union.
Is there any question, if you don't mind me breaking in here, William, just a second. I was listening to what Tom just said.
Mm.
And it seems very poignant, particularly with the history of the last 3 weeks, that the nuclear reactor up in the Ukraine should have had its problem, which it shouldn't have had. It had worked for a long, long time. Now, we know that the Soviets are playing with scalar. Tom, do you have any...
Well, the only conclusion I can draw is that they had a drastic nuclear accident before, in the winter of 57, 58, apparently.
Yeah, up in the Ural Mountains.
Up near the Urals. And what happened there was, according to eyewitnesses in the area, people from the area itself, it was stored radioactive waste material, which exploded.
A waste dump.
A waste dump. Now, that makes sense. We know that in 1960, Khrushchev announced they were playing with these fantastic weapons. In other words, they were well along in research and development. We know they went operational in 1963. So in 1957, they were in research and development with these things. And the kind of accident you could have had would have been if you had a big transmitter you're playing with and you had built up one of these powerful standing scalar waves, which is what you use, standing waves. The more energy you put into that thing in the form of gravitational energy, the more the amplitude of the wave in your standing wave. A peculiar effect comes out of that. If you have a failure in the transmitter, just a common garden variety, ordinary, everyday failure, all of that energy that you've got connected to you is connected through your equipment into the grounding of your electromagnetic equipment, in the ground itself, you will get a discharge of that gigantic standing wave energy, just like you had a very huge Tesla coil or a tremendous capacitor shorted out to the ground. In the ground, then, you will get not an electromagnetic pulse, not an EMP, but an electrogravitational pulse, an EGP. And the first nuclear thing close to that is going to go bananas. It's going to go with an extreme pulse of radioactivity. And that's what happened, I believe, in 1957-58. I think they were playing one of these things. They had an ordinary garden variety failure. They got an EGP in the ground. The nuclear waste nearby exploded and contaminated that whole vast area, which is contaminated to this day.
To this very day. You know, it just dawned on me, Tom, the last time we talked, it was shortly after May Day of a year ago, in which we saw an enormous amount of activity on the part of the Soviets.
Yes, as you recall, in May Day, Gorbachev had taken power, of course, as a new leader. He hadn't been in there too long. And what apparently happened that particular year, 1985, was their 40th anniversary of the ending of World War II, which was a very big thing to the Soviet Union. They lost millions and millions of people in World War II.
Yes.
So they had a very a gigantic celebration for the end of that war, the 40th anniversary. And one of the things that happened was they activated the entire, with a giant exercise, they activated the entire scalar weapon system, the big monsters that they have. One of the simple little things they did, which was monstrous, and I simply cannot describe what kind of a feeling it gives you to stand and look at a screen with 54 different frequencies upon that screen, signals, if you will, each one which represents the entire Earth beneath your feet, in electrogravitational resonance on 54 different frequencies. Mother Earth itself in monstrous resonance controlled from the Soviet Union. And that occurred in 1985.
What about 1986? Did they do it again?
Well, the alarmed us in 1985, to say the least, because we didn't know whether or not they were going to move or what, but it was obvious that something quite different from anything else we'd ever seen or dreamed of was occurring. Then they started turning some things on and some things off, back on and off. It became obvious it was a giant exercise of the whole strategic scalar weapon system. And we realized they really weren't going to move against the whole world, but just exercising the system. One of the things that's interesting about those 54 frequencies, I've been asked many times, how do they power the gigantic power that's put into the Tesla shields and things like that? Well, they do it very simply. You take two of those frequencies into the Earth, and as you know, you have a rather large amount of energy going on inside the molten core of the Earth, like a giant cathode, so to speak. All you have to do then is bias one of those scalar frequencies. You go in on resonances of the Earth. There are broad resonances there. These were in pairs 12 kilohertz apart, as monitored by Frank Golden, with a very special scalar electromagnetic detection system that he has developed. You take two frequencies 12 kilohertz apart, go into resonance through the Earth, into the molten core of the Earth, and then you simply lower the potential on one of your frequencies, and you can extract all the amperage and all the voltage you need right out of the Earth itself. And it'll be a 12 kilohertz frequency, which is what they were taking out of the Earth and using each of those taps. So there were 27 power taps going on as of May Day 1985 in the molten core of Mother Earth itself. And those gigantic power taps are used to power these weapons I'm talking about. I'm estimating that one power tap can power about six weapons, four to six. If that's accurate, then as of May of last year, they had activated well over 100 of these giant weapons.
And the weapons make all of the hydrogen weapons that we have child's play.
That's correct. They're one of the simple things you could do, for example, to show you how frightening it can be if you wish to. You know, Brezhnev in 75 used the phrase, more frightening than the mind of man has ever imagined. And in 75, it was so frightful, even the Russians were afraid and tried to get an agreement with the United Nations, with the nations of the world, as a matter of fact, to outlaw the development of such weapons. They actually, Gromyko actually introduced into the United Nations such a draft agreement and asked for signatures. And Article 1 of that agreement said, we'll negotiate the type of weapons we're talking about when we start negotiations on the agreement.
Okay, William, does that help you?
I think it does. That was the impression that I had, too, that these could be set off by exercising the natural gravitational resonances of the elements involved.
Yes, one of the deadly dangers, William, since you asked the question, and you certainly have the intuition to see it, I'll go ahead and give you, if you send a pulse around through the Earth, and it'll travel through the Earth as well as, you know, use a normal carrier to carry around the ionospheric waveguide, you can send it through the Earth, and you can focus it in across two beams, for example, in a place where we have missile silos.
Correct.
Okay? If you pulse a strong electrogravitational pulse in that intersection with the missile silos, you'll blow all the warheads. You can use your opponent's nuclear warheads to obliterate him.
You might also be able to then extract the energy and send it somewhere else and start a major conflagration somewhere.
I don't know just how far along they are at extracting something that's going nuclear like that. That'd probably be pretty dangerous. I really don't know whether they can handle that or not. The thing is, I don't believe the Soviets want to blow up the world. They want to take it over. But they're not fools. They do not want the whole Earth contaminated. You know, they need the farmland of the United States. They need the soil.
Well, if they blew the missiles up in the silos, though, they wouldn't really be contaminating a large percent of the Earth, because we do underground nuclear testing now.
Yeah, but when we do an underground nuclear test, William, we dig a big hole way down deep in the rock.
Right.
So that we don't vent that explosion. We don't vent all that radioactivity. If you blew those things in the silos, you would vent all of that. You'd have monstrous tonnages of deadly hot dirt turned up into the atmosphere, carried around the Earth, dumped everywhere. You would have fallout on massive scales throughout the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, William.
Thank you.
One thing to remind, just to put in your mind, when is the last time we made a successful launch in the United States. And with that, I'll let you go. We'll be back with Tom Bearden in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind on Talk Radio 79, KABC.
Mr. Bearden, I'm the person who sent you some airbrush drawings just recently of some cloud formation.
Fantastic, and I do thank you from the bottom of my heart.
And without going into it too much in detail, I just wanted to know, I was curious to know if there had been any further sightings since then.
Yes,
especially
both
on the East Coast.
California and here in Alabama.
There have been since
yes.
then. I'm very interested in getting hold of your book. You said it was coming out soon. When
about
will it be out?
3 weeks from now.
When will it be out, and how can I get hold?
It'll be out about 3 weeks. Of course, you have a complimentary copy coming because, with your kind consent, I have shown the three drawings that you sent me.
Oh, thank you very much. I thought it was going to be a videotape, but I love the book.
Well, the videotape comes next.
Okay. That'll be very fun. I'm also interested to know, I was kind of surprised that with the Russians' ability to do all these things, they were so non-adept at their Chernobyl accident, and I wonder why they had to call Germany to find out how to put it out.
Well, you know, nobody has ever tried, as far as I know, including the Soviets, had ever tried to put out
a graphite fire.
A really massive graphite fire like that. There's nothing that I know of, and the textbooks tell you how to do it.
Oh, I see. They just sounded so inadept.
I think that they broke a lot of new ground, and I think they just sort of tried everything in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from flying helicopters over it and dropping, you know, lead and sand and everything else, to doing everything they could to try to put it out.
They just knew they had to put it out.
Yeah.
That was the name of that tune.
I know they did.
I rather suspect there were some rather strange things done to finally get it under control, not really the sand and the lead. I don't think that'll put out a graphite fire.
Well, thank you very much. That's all I wanted, and I'll look forward to the book.
All right,
okay,
Margaret.
Thank you, Margaret. In case the listening audience is wondering what we were talking about there, Margaret Wilson is an excellent airbrush artist, and she had a most amazing sighting of three giant radial cloud formations form one right after the other, some 10 minutes or so apart, out there in California. And so she immediately did beautiful sketches of those formations and how they lay in the sky and so forth, and very kindly furnished those to me to use and show everybody what was really going on in the sky. And I did use those in the book, and the book will be out in about 3 weeks or so.
Well, Margaret, between your airbrush and my camera, we may get some things going around here. All right, thank you very much, Margaret. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind on Talk Radio 79 KABC. A wreck on the freeway or a stabbing in East Los Angeles with a lot better news.
I have to chuckle, Bill, because she's making a very good point.
A very good point.
Let me see if I can express that point in a little different fashion, because I certainly agree with her very much.
I'm worried about us.
For example, you know, what happened in Mexico last week? I really don't know. And not very many Americans do know what happened in Mexico last week, and yet Mexico is right on our southern border. Well, what happened in Canada last week that was important to the Canadians? Again, I have to say, I really don't know, and most Americans don't know what happened in Canada last week.
Hey, they can't even figure out what the word Soviet means.
That's right.
Well, nobody, but you see, that is so imperiling our society to be so backward. I mean, knowledge does give you power.
That's correct. What we really need, and if anybody knows where one is, I'd certainly like to find it, is some kind of objective coverage that sort of goes through the whole world, like at least once a week, and gives you a weekly update on the main things that are happening all over the world.
You want to pay for my round-trip tickets on these trips, I'll let you know.
But the prevailing part of the news, of course, everything is commercialized, and you've got to sell newspapers, and you've got to sell and package the news.
Mm.
And so really they have almost a formula by which they cover things. They segment it into certain areas, and they go right through those areas. They go primarily in this world, this region of the world, maybe what the Soviets are doing in opposition to us. Something along that line, and once in a while you'll hear if there's a big earthquake in Indonesia or something like that.
They're not in opposition to us. They want to progress, period. If that is opposition.
Hey, Joanne?
Yes.
We're going to take a break, and you can stay on the line, all right? Because
all right.
You're giving us some very, very penetrating stories. But I might bring to your attention and yours too, Tom, that here on this network on Sunday morning, we have a series of broadcasts called Perspective from all the points of the world. And they do a marvelous job that touches ever so lightly those things that you're talking about.
Well, that's marvelous. I wish we had that here.
We are ever so lightly touching the weather wars with Thomas E. Bearden, John Bedini in studio, and a whole new massive technology that seems to be arrayed against us. We'll get into it after the news, so stay with us. We've got a weather wars update, a whole new level of technology that is mind-boggling to most, and unfortunately, there's compelling evidence to believe that may be used against us. And no one knows more about this, I suppose, than Tom. We have Joanne on the line. Bring you back in, Joanne. You want to continue with your question?
Well, you say this is a war against that may end up against us, but when I was in those Siberian territories, talking to directors, and my husband and I were just genuine tourists, they'll tell you why they're doing these things, and they tell you why the weather is going to be affected. Siberia is floating in oil, heat, diamonds, minerals coming out of their ears. How can they do it if they don't have electric power? Now, the thing is, what I don't understand is, if an ordinary tourist like I, who did a lot of reading before I went, and can find all this out, what is the matter? I mean, it's just, I've seen atomic energy plants when I was there. I was a little shocked at how close they were to large population centers. You call, as I said, the RAND Corporation, and you ask them questions, they get mad at you, and you say, well, why don't you know, well, how do you know these answers? We read it in the paper. I mean, we're losing the ball game. And that bothers me that our people are so ignorant for no reason at all.
But it bothers me, too, that they're not well informed like that. But let me assure you that the dams in Siberia are not causing the weather war that I'm talking about at all.
Well, when I left this country, I did 3 years of reading, and I can tell you that scientists, according to those articles I read, said that the damming of those gigantic rivers that flow to the northern polar ice cap would change global weather, and that was one of the things that I could ask these various questions of the directors of these plants, because I had gone there with some information, and they admit that it would do that.
Well, sunspots change global weather, too, but again, that's not what I'm talking about at all.
Yes, but I'm just saying that we don't even talk in this aspect. Now, this has been going on for 20 years. And we're still not talking about it. I mean, this is just one aspect.
That's correct.
What can I say? We're just not with it. Yet the other day, Mr. Posner was on the Bill Donahue show, and he said three times, call us Soviets. Everybody called them Russians. The word Russia has not existed on a map of the world for 60 years. And we're still calling it that. The 7 o'clock news calls it that. But the President of the United States doesn't call it that.
Your point now, Joanne?
My point is, if the media and the books and the people who use the airways do not hurry up and educate us when a lot of them know the answers, we're already doomed. Because knowledge is power.
Well, that's what we're trying to dispel here, or put out for you tonight, is some knowledge. Now, we're talking about some weather wars.
Yes, but you know what?
We're talking about a type of weather war that has far greater implications than the damming of giant rivers.
Well, I'm just...
The damming of giant rivers is not going to create a 90-degree bend in the jet streams, as we've seen. We're talking about a technology that is emanating from the Soviet Union.
Well, it isn't a war against us. It's that they want to progress.
Well, I tell you what.
I tell you, if it's a war against us and they killed hundreds of Americans already, it doesn't matter whether we believe it or not. It's true. They've done it.
Well, I don't think that's the motivation. The motivation is to pull the Soviet Union further into technology. But I want to say one more thing. You've given me a lot of time. I think it's wonderful that you did. You've been altogether wonderful, and I feel that I should hang up while I'm ahead.
Well, I think your point about us being ill-informed about other places in the world is certainly well taken, and I certainly agree with that.
I have talked to Joanne. I recognize your voice now.
I've talked
to her before, and she is always on target. She's corrected me on a number of salient points from time to time, and I hope that they have translated themselves into my conduct on the air, Joanne. And I appreciate your interest in the work that we do here at KABC.
I'm interested in our country.
Sure you are.
And I hope that that comes through that way.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, hon. Thank you very much. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind, and with me is Tom Bearden, and we're talking to Chris.
Hello, Bill.
Yes.
I found very fascinating what your previous caller had to say.
He's a pretty sharp gal.
I'd like to comment on that in a tangent way. A couple of years ago with the KL007 shootdown,
mm-hmm.
I read a book called How Democracies Perish. I wonder if you ever got around to that one. Jean-Francois Ravel, the French philosopher.
It is in my library, and I must admit that there are other ones ahead of it. I wish I had enough time to read all the books I should read.
Well, up until that point, I was wondering how it was that the superpower gambit would come out, how we could really outlast or finally outwit the gangsters in the Kremlin.
Well, there are a bunch of gangsters that are not necessarily headquartered in the Kremlin.
Well, I would say anybody in a totalitarian regime who would give the go-ahead to kill innocent people with Skeller technology would be classified as a criminal.
Very definitely.
All right. That's where I'm coming from.
Or any other kind of technology.
Granted. A few blips from this book. I'll just read two. They're one sentence long apiece. And one is, democracy is not structured to defend itself against enemies seeking its annihilation. Another is, we have become so accustomed to surrender that it is now the norm. Since I read that book several years ago, I have been waiting and watching various shows, yours, magazines, this and that, mainstream and offbeat, as we would call offbeat. And I've been waiting for the modus operandi, or for the instrument of destruction to appear. I was looking for the ace in the hole, and I found it. And it's Geller technology.
It certainly is, and we started talking about it 3.5 years ago.
I go back with your show about 1.5 years.
Yeah.
And my mouth hits the floor. It's a nightmare that won't go away.
On the other hand, Chris, scalar technology is one of the most pristine and beautiful things that ever happened to our society, but like a hammer.
Yeah, and in the hands of madmen or criminals, you know exactly what's going to happen. Unless there is some cosmological reason why this weapon will not be used, it will be used. And 60 or 70 years of Kremlin gangstery says that that is the case.
We have an almost ace in the hole, Tom. I think you'll agree with this, that the implementation of the full force of scalar technology in its weapons mode, it's like shooting at someone in the same pond you're standing in because there are no targets.
You are a target, too. I was listening while Chris was talking about the cosmological principle. There is a cosmological principle that makes it extremely risky and extremely difficult to use this technology in a warlike mode. And that is the sun, for example, in addition to pouring out the normal electromagnetic waves that we all know about, it pours out incredible amounts of scalar waves, electrogravitational radiation. Now, this component is what Tesla was referring to as including in cosmic radiation. Now, Tesla called them cosmic rays, and he reported measuring rays going 50 times the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
These scalar waves from the sun, the giant scalar waves, penetrate deeply into the Earth. When they get down to regions where there's lots of pressure and everything, things are highly nonlinear. The stresses that are stressed together in these waves that make a vector zero start to dephase. And you have ordinary electromagnetic energy emerging. That's really what heats the molten core of the Earth, not the normal stuff we're taught. And what keeps it going and not cooling all the time. Then since the scalar waves, however, are absorbed by nuclei, the part that is not broken up, that is not dephased,
is absorbed by the nuclei in the Earth and re-radiated. So a part of that goes back into the sun. In other words, I'm describing a closed-loop system. There is such a closed-loop system between the moon and the Earth and between the moon and the sun also. Now, the sun also has scalar resonances in it. If you trigger on the Earth by massive activity, if you hit inadvertently one of those triggers in the sun and trigger a sort of a giant burp, if you will, of the sun, you can have the Earth burnt to a crisp by eruptions from the sun. And that's the kind of risk you have to run if you want to use these things massively. Now, that is the meaning of the phrase that Khrushchev used in 1960 when he said, these weapons are so powerful that if unrestrainedly used, they could wipe out all life on Earth. That's what he was talking about.
Well, what we're seeing now, Tom, is just a little fiddling around.
They have been moving very cautiously, step by step, making very, very sure that they don't trigger anything cosmological from us. For example, if you trigger the scalar resonances with the moon exerts a massive influence on the tides in the Earth, the tides in the ocean and the tides in the Earth itself. And so you could get massive earthquakes, gigantic eruptions of volcanoes and everything else, and massive tidal waves in the ocean and so forth if you hit that one. And so, yes, indeed, there are some cosmological kickbacks to this kind of a thing that you use as a weapon that don't exist for any other kind of weapon at all.
All right, let's say let's say the President of the United States is awoken by a messenger who says from the Kremlin, somebody out of Washington, the Soviet embassy, I want you to witness something here. We're going to detonate in the silos warheads, Minuteman warheads, A through F, in about 20 minutes. We'll be waiting for you at the negotiating table at that time, and a half an hour after that. If you don't show up, we're going to detonate F through H or Z or something. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If it's that fine tuned and they're just going to tweak a little bit, and the government who knows about this, I suspect pretty much, Tom, and you know what the reaction is going to be. What will be their alternative to surrender at that point?
Well, we're not going to have that scenario for this reason, Chris. The Soviet Union is not the only nation that has these weapons. I'm not at liberty to name the other nation. It is not us. But it is not a hostile nation. For example, not too long back, six major Soviet missile ammunition storage sites blew up in the space of 7 months. Now, I personally believe, and I couldn't, of course, prove this at all, but I believe that those explosions were probably caused by this other country, showing the Russians that if you decide to get too risky with this, you're going to get your own leg blown off.
I suspect it's the United Kingdom, but you don't have to say anything.
Well, I can't confirm which nation it is at all. But in other words, they are not just free to do whatever they want to. They have to run to do anything at all in the weapons fashion. They have to take terrible risk, both by getting a kickback on them from, let's say, another nation, and by getting a gigantic kickback on them from the cosmos itself. I think that this thing is so risky that there's a serious problem in the Soviet Union in using them. I think, for example, in 1975, there was a debate between if we could use the terms the hawks and the doves. And the doves, for a moment, clearer heads prevailed, that the risk was too great for the whole human species, not just to Russia vis-a-vis U.S. and so forth. And I think at that point, we really had a chance to outlaw the development of such monsters, and we missed it because we didn't know what in the world they were talking about when Brezhnev was trying to get us to agree to outlawing such weapons. Because they had had the weapons since 63, on site and operational. They certainly knew what the risks were, and they knew, how terrible the kickback could be.
Well, let me just interject. A clear, sober sizing up of Soviet intentions, ultimate Soviet intentions, pretty much states that unless the system itself is drastically altered, that the procurement and further development and research of these weapons will not stop. They will continue to move ahead.
That's correct.
All right. At what point do you believe they will be able to implement such weaponry as to bring about the complete political, geopolitical change of the world?
Well, they had planned on achieving that capability in 1985. In 1972, Brezhnev, speaking at a secret meeting of the Communist Party leaders from Europe, told them that in 1985 they would control all the oceans of the world, 90% of the land areas, and the space above everything. He used the term control. He didn't say they would invade anything.
Right.
And I think that's steadily what they've been moving to with these things, and that's really what I've described in great detail in the new book.
I'm dying to see this. Do you have a title for me or what?
The title would be called Ferdinand.
All right, and I can look for it where?
Hey, look for it at Tesla Book Company in about 3 weeks.
All right, now, one more thing. I know I'm taking up time. I'm sorry, but what happens if they pull this off before it becomes a known within certain hierarchical realms of the Beltway in Washington? I mean that they're going to have some guy, some wonderful scientist from Huntsville come up here and saying, look, this is what's happening. They're going to say, hey, why don't you get the hell out? We think we
can do that all the time.
That's exactly what they do say, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Fortunately, Washington is quite often being bypassed on this one.
Let me just say this, Chris. I'm going to have to choose my words very carefully.
All right, I'm listening.
I believe I have good reason to believe they will not do that. They're not be able to do that. There are some things I cannot say at all. There are some people in the United States who have done far more work than they will ever be able to say publicly. And one of them is seated in the studio there tonight, John Bedini. Another is Frank Golden. And I think that, I'll just have to leave it at that. I do not think the Soviet Union is going to find it in their best interest to continue to pursue the kinds of things they're doing. And I don't think that it's going to be that long until the U.S. government is fully on board in this thing. I'm very optimistic this year. I was optimistic last year and it did not occur. But I'm even more optimistic this year.
The script
it is seriously being listened to in the government now, even though they still don't believe it. They are certainly not laughing anymore. There's just too much data behind it.
Does this have anything to do with the perfectly preserved bodies, victims of Afghanistan, and things like that?
Partly to do with that. There's a whole stream of things. I would say, if I had to estimate a number, probably about 200 things that go from anything from little incidents to major incidents that all fit the pattern. Well, you know, like working a jigsaw puzzle, when you don't have all the pieces fitted together, you only got one or two, you can't tell what the picture is. But when you begin to get a rather large number of them together, even though there's still gaps, you can begin to get a pretty good idea of what that picture is.
Well,
that's the point that it's moving into now.
Chris, I think there's a great important lesson to be learned here. One is that the American people, by and large, seem to think that the government of the United States can do all and see all and is all, when in actuality it is the genius of the American people that does all and sees all and is all.
If I may interject there, for what little time we have left, if the Soviets do something stupid, I want to know when I can hear my stereophonic records on John's Optifonics. I want to know when I can buy such a set.
We're going to get into that in just a second. We were going to kind of run down to 10:30 on the weather wars.
All right.
Because we've looked at one side of scalar technology, which is an ominous side. But there seems to be some countering going on to it. But there is a pristine side.
Well, my ears are open.
All right, Chris, I appreciate your call very much. I'm Bill Jenkins. You're on Open Mind tonight with Tom Bearden and John Bedini on KABC Talk Radio 79. People who want to talk to you about the other, but there is a bright side.
No, let's talk about the bright side.
Let's talk about the bright side a little bit. In, you know, I've been holding your hand for a long time, John, about the discovery of this new science, scalar electromagnetics. You have found something else to do with it. We have mentioned it here a couple of times. Optophonics, which is, in such an odd way, such a marvelous thing, but it comes out of a weapon system. What is optophonics? What is it?
Optophonics is the use of interferometry through optical beams.
Uh-huh.
And, you see, we found out that if we could take actually, I found out a while back that if we took optical beams and phased them correctly, made a zero out of them, which everybody says, well, what's a zero? You know, there's nothing there, John. But there is something there. There's something very unique there that everything stems from a zero.
You all right, now, whenever you say zero, John, you're talking to Bill here. We're talking dumb person. What do you mean a zero?
Well, what I mean is that we take the normal electromagnetic waves and we cancel them out and make a zero.
So there's no electromagnetic wave at all?
So there's no wave at all, but something happens in the process here, with optical especially, and that you get exactly what Dr. Tesla was talking about. You get two 180-degree waves that come together in the center of your head through the use of optophonics. So your ears not necessarily are hearing this.
Something else is causing you.
Right, and you can cause things to circle inside your head. You get a real good feeling. You can learn. You can learn from this. This is a process by which you can take the information and absorb it.
Is there any relationship to what you're doing with optophonics to what we have talked about here quite often with your good friend of mine, Dr. Patrick Flanagan, with his Neurophone? Was he heading in that same direction all those many years ago?
Yes, yes and no.
Yeah.
All right. Dr. Flanagan, of course, his goes through the skin.
Right.
This one here, we wear a normal pair of earphones, and we transmit two out-of-phase beams right into the center through your auditory system.
Mm-hmm.
And this ends up right in the center of your head, as you know from using the little box.
Right.
And it is possible to highlight things and make the instruments move around in a circular pattern.
Well, you don't even have to use the earphones sometimes.
Yes. Well, you can use speakers. You can use the earphones. I'm sure that it could be incorporated in something like a Neurophone, to where this goes right to the center.
Yeah, because the Neurophone is using a digital square wave, and it uses the sensory perception ability of the skin in order to get sound into your head.
Right.
You don't have to use your ears to get sound in the head.
That's it. You can use the skin. You can use your auditory system.
In fact, you were listening to things in your mother's womb before you even had ears, because you were listening to it through the skin. So optophonics is actually affecting that sensory perception that we have, as well as the ear.
And it does it through these spike currents.
You gave me a tape, a demonstration tape of optophonics that I played. I brought it down here for the engineers and let them listen to it. They are amazed. They don't believe it. You know, they sit back there and huddle over their gizmos and they just can't hear what they're hearing. They can't believe what they're hearing.
Well, you see, there's no signal there.
Yes.
All right? If they try to look at it in a mono situation, with people like to center images by mono, all right? And by centering that image, they can balance their speakers. But since optophonics is neither mono or stereo, there is no mono.
Well, stereo.
There's no stereo.
Well, stereo, of course, is a gimmick. You don't hear that way. It's a little more pleasant than mono. There's no doubt about that.
Right. You hear in bimonorally.
But optophonics is the way you hear.
Exactly.
Now, you were so kind to come over and rig that into my television system over at my house the other day. And somebody brought something in and unplugged it. Now, I was listening to television this afternoon, and I walked out. I can't stand that anymore because you got to hook my optophonics back up because I don't want to hear it anymore. It totally, completely changes. If you're watching television, for instance, as we're doing there, I'm hearing it in a very, very natural stereo. It's surrounding me. It's behind me and all around me, and it's just a normal television signal.
That's right, but it makes you part of the play.
That's
it
right.
It rocks you to the center of the picture.
And KABC sounds great on optophonics.
It does.
And one of these days, I think the radio stations everywhere will be broadcasting in optophonics. I was playing the tape that you gave me in my car, and there are four speakers in the car as I was driving down, and the whole car is filled with the sound that's swirling around.
You see, optophonics also, Bill, has no room resonance problems.
Right.
Because the waves are not all pushing out at you at the same time. You see, it's like you become part of the circle.
I also notice that when you walk into the room where the optophonics is being used, that there's something compelling about just wanting to stay there. Why is... What are you doing to me? Are you some...
Well,
have you got a little signal that says,
optical,
watch or listen?
The optical beams are scanning. And they're scanning at a very good resonance. 8 hertz, 7.38, because they're photon controlled. In other words, the natural environment, the Schumann resonance, is involved here.
Mm-hmm.
See, these beams, I guess you would have to say that if you were standing inside this little chip, it would be like a laser light going by you that was about the size of a trash can, but for a great distance.
Yeah.
Right? But somewhere in the center, it becomes black. In that particular point to where it becomes black, there's nothing. Yet, the phototransistors that are used in this chip detect something that we are very unfamiliar with.
I know you've seen
that. John sent me a tape, and it's fantastic.
Ah, so you felt that too.
Well, it's incredible. Of course, I've known that he was working in this area from working with him, and I've known... a little bit about some of the marvelous things he's doing with those chips he's using. And let me tell you, that is some fantastic feats of engineering he's done there. There's nothing else like that anywhere that I know of.
Well, once you have listened to the optophonic sound, you want to throw your stereo out the window. And certainly your mono thing out the window. And in fact, there's no reason to ever have mono again. Because you can convert a mono signal to this optophonic signal, and you've got something totally new, totally delightful. And, of course, in this business that I'm in, that always appeals to me, which is one of the uses of scalar technology. Now, this, of course, seems to be maybe a frivolous one, but sound has to do with communication and education. And the more that you can make sound more palatable and make it better, the better you can educate and the better you can share experience.
Well, Bill, you know, a lot of people ask. They say, how can you get something out of nothing?
Mm-hmm.
Because the nothing is full of energy. And we just, as a race of people, have not been able to tap this because we don't understand it too well. Now, we're working on this.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding out that there are spectrums with this technology that are very beneficial. One of those may pop up to be healing. Did anybody ever think that maybe you could go someday into a doctor's office and listen to some music and all of a sudden you don't have that disease anymore? Because this technology makes possible certain resonances. And by using those resonances, the disease cannot exist. You pump it.
You just left me, John. I love the idea.
Well,
I'm not sure whether the AMA would, but I do.
Well, the AMA is of no concern to me.
I mean, either.
You know, we could go into a long subject about this, but...
Let's don't.
Let's not. Let's just take just for a moment, and we'll all just open up our minds out there just for a moment, and let's just think what we're controlled by. We are all controlled by frequencies. We're very resonant. We're very adaptive to certain situations. Have you ever seen anybody play certain type of music and all of a sudden the whole audience is just relaxed?
Mm-hmm.
There are people who do this.
On the other hand, whenever the kids come in at my house, they put on a certain type of music and I get very agitated.
But the point is, Bill, that since we're so frequency-oriented, that it must be, the cures must be in scalar technology and certain resonances.
The reason I led you down this line of thought, and I didn't mean to be tongue-in-cheek along the way, is that certainly scalar interferometry goes far beyond giving you a whole new experience in listening to music or sound, you know, from your set. There is a whole new experience to be experienced by this, the people of this planet, in the very way that they maintain their health.
That's right.
The very way that they stop the aging process. The very way that they are able to fend off any kind of virus or any problem, because you shouldn't have that if you're in resonance and if your frequencies are right. And with the scalar, we can get those things back the way they should be. Rather than using chemicals and knives, going to use a chip, children. And one of these days, and it's not too far away, hospitals are going to be places where they set bones and sew up wounds, and that's about it.
That's right, because the use of the technology has much more benefits for good than for bad.
Unfortunately, in this society that we have, and you can just look at it historically, Tom, I think you'll agree, when there have been great technological breakthroughs, the structures of government, the structures of our economics, say that the only way that you can get the necessary research to bring this technology online is to first make a weapon out of it. Then the government will get full behind it and bring it on. And then after the weapon is made, maybe we can save lives. Which is a tribute to the great mentality of the human species.
Well, I think we ought to save all the lives, Bill.
Well, you're strange, John.
I must be.
Well, of course, we have a problem in the whole area in that ever since the time of Tesla, this technology has been rigorously suppressed in Western society. They've gone to a great deal of trouble to suppress it because it's been repeatedly discovered, at least parts of it have been, and just rather ruthlessly stamped out every time it has been. The real reason that it's been suppressed is exactly what John's talking about. You can cure diseases with it, just as Antoine Priori did with the Priori device in France, which was really a scalar electromagnetic device. It was a big monster because he didn't know the chip technology and so forth like John's using. But I foresee the kind of technology that John's talking about producing, for example, a real honest-to-God cure for cancer and leukemia. I don't think it would be that hard to do it. And I think John Benigni is probably the very guy that could do it.
Well, I tell you one of the interesting things, and I can relate to this personally, and I've talked about this before, so I'm not letting anything out of school. And, John, I know you didn't want me to talk about it too much. But it was less than a year ago that my son sustained a injury to his knee that was more severe than the one that Pedro Guerrero is now experiencing with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And we have lost Pedro for the Dodgers for most of this year, if not all of it. Within a month, my son was walking without any problem whatsoever.
That's right.
And John did that with whatever that was over there, John.
Well, these are the benefits of scalar.
Yeah, Tommy Lasorda, if you're listening, right, will take care of Pedro. But
these are the benefits, Bill, of scalar technology. You see, over here especially, we are not allowed to do anything that may help somebody without the gold seal on it. In other words, you have to have the gold seal by the money makers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that gold seal, of course, is going to cost a person
bunch of money.
Well, his house, his credit cards, his car, everything, all right? Everything you own, you go to the hospital and it's theirs. What do you have when you get out? You might have just a little bit more than when you went in.
Well, it gets back to that old story that we have told here quite often and quite eloquently, and certainly Tom Bearden is one of the best tellers of that story, how the world would have been a much better place had Nikola Tesla never met J.P. Morgan.
Now, he was warned.
J.P. Morgan was not interested in the development of mankind. He was only interested in money.
Well, I think his key phrase, Bill, was one source of power, one, only one, anybody can milk our cow.
Yeah.
We're not going to have that. Fire him.
So he shut off free energy, and he shut off a whole new technology in sake of the god-awful dollar.
But the free energy bill now is popping up.
Mm-hmm.
I think
everywhere
that we have two people that have done this. They have taken a book. And these are normal people.
What we're going to do, what John is talking about, we have talked about the free energy before and all of that technology. And during the course of the last week, we found two very, well, they found us, really, two very skilled people that took the very basic information that John has published and we've talked about on the show. Tom, I think you're familiar with this.
Yeah.
We're going to call them just Roy and Bill. Ray and Bill, that's their first names. We'll talk to them for a second. And they have done it. And they are rather well-placed engineers. They know exactly what they're talking about, and they understand what John is talking about.
They get 20 gold stars for
20 gold stars. And we'll talk to them in just a few moments. Right now, you're in a conversation with John Bedini and with Tom Bearden. We're talking about the bright side of scalar electromagnetics. It is probably the great hope, the greatest hope that we have seen in a long time. I'm Bill Jenkins.
Some objection to it, yet presents an open mind. And as the name of your show is.
Yes.
And therefore, finally comes around once he sees the facts. I mean, the facts can't be denied. And the third, of course, is they would accept anything, you know, no matter what you tell them. So those kind aren't so good either. But there are three definite basic types.
Well, you know, you live in a rather advanced, I can't get into your background. You've asked for that anonymity. But a group, your peer group, are very advanced people. You're involved in some of our leading organizations here where science is supposed to be what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you show them, here it is. And yet, they're going to take question with you, even though they're looking at it, working, because it doesn't fit the mold of the book they have back in their office. Does that say too much for us, sir?
That's exactly what happens quite often.
Yeah, I'd like to point out here that the books that we have are only the ones that John and Tom and all mention every time that they're on the program.
Yes.
They always tell that they go to the Tesla Book Company, these are available. So we said, well, let's get them, and they're very inexpensive. They cost about the price of a magazine or something like that. They're not expensive to get. So we sent the best Tesla books, or we got the books, and it looked impossible at first, but then... So we said, well, let's have an open mind, and we wanted to try it.
Good for you.
All right, now...
And I was one of the ones that was skeptical, may I add.
But there were some things that were difficult for us. We didn't feel that we could build one of the special generators, so we said, well, now, why can't we really do the same thing with just the electronic logic? Now, let me say also that the level of electronics that we have is nothing very deep. It's things like you might read about in a popular electronics magazine. And the science within it is something that you might read in Scientific American. It's something that just any ordinary people can understand.
Can you wait just a second there, Ray?
Yeah.
I'm just an ordinary talk show host that's behind schedule with something very important. Call it a commercial. And I'll be right back with you. We have Bill and Ray on the line talking to John Bedini and Tom Bearden. Bill and Ray are in the electronic industry. They know their electronics very well. They took these impossible ideas of our resident madman, John Bedini and Tom Bearden, and found out that they work. And it's a fascinating story. So you stay with me. I'll be right back on Talk Radio 79 KABC. Physicist with, we will say, a rather large corporation who should know better. That on their own time, they took John's book and Tom Bearden, who is also with us on the phone from Huntsville, Alabama, and started working with this impossible thing about scalar interferometry that John had been talking about and we had been talking about here on the air. And guys, Bill and Ray, you get 5 stars. Because on your own, you didn't call me, you didn't call John, you didn't call Tom. You did it, and you found out that, my goodness gracious, it works.
Yes, definitely. Ray is the one that eventually got the material. I think he listened to your show, and, well, Ray, you tell him what happened from there.
Well, on the show, you remember, Bill, you suggested that you tape it because you're going to probably want to hear it again. And so I did. I taped it, then I shared it with Bill. And it sounded impossible.
But you made the impossible come true.
But
now, what I'm going to do here,
yeah.
We've done it again. We've run up to the 11 o'clock hour. You guys have time to go get a cup of coffee. We want to hear this story totally and completely because we're going to take a break for news. But it's Something I don't want anybody to miss. And turn on your tapes because you're going to learn a lot of new things in this next hour from John Bedini and Tom Bearden and Ray and Bill on Open Mind. It's called Scalar Interferometry. And it takes many dimensions, from awesome weapons to healing, the likes of which you have never seen, to hearing, the likes of which you have never heard. And the men that are in the forefront of this particular science is in the studio. One of them is John C. Bedini. On the phone from Huntsville, Alabama, is Thomas E. Bearden. And also on the phone are two of our peers that live here in Los Angeles that heard us talk about this, read the material that John had published and Tom had published, went about in their own spare time. They work with one of our major corporations and found out that it was true. I hated to pause in the middle of your story. We have Bill and Ray on the line. Ray, go ahead and continue.
Okay, well, see, one of the experiments that John had run and was written in the paper that Ike and Yoder wrote up is where he took four partially discharged batteries, and with no other power input, he had the four batteries recharge themselves, while at the same time he was operating a 75-watt quartz light as a load, and they recharged themselves.
True.
So Bill and I said, well, why use four batteries? Why can't we have one battery recharge itself? And so using the G-field generator system that we simulated by electronic logic circuits, we were able to do this. And we proved all the strange things that John had talked about. Now, everything works backwards. But that part of it is where Bill is really better qualified to explain that.
The whole world of electromagnetics seems to be upside down, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Go ahead, Bill.
Well, you see, the interesting part about the whole thing is, as I read through the literature, which took me a couple of months, I guess, it's pretty complicated stuff, the very first thing that dawned on me, that grabbed me, really, was Tom Bearden's explanation of a zero vector.
Right, now Tom's on the line, Tom. Are you still there, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, you got Tom on the line.
Yeah, your explanation of a zero vector, once it sunk in, once I understood what you meant by scalar, what everybody's talking about by scalar, I was astounded at the absolute incredible possibilities of such a thing.
It turns your electromagnetics into gravity.
Yes, it's absolutely astounding. The implications that's involved here. Now, so at any rate, I also moved on then to John Bendini's G-field generator there and took a look at exactly what he was doing with that. I tried to understand exactly what he was doing with that anyway. And that took a while.
You think that took a while? I took John with me down to Town Hall in our prestigious group. What's about a little over a year ago.
That was the broadcast that was started.
And we demonstrated that down at Town Hall, and we were there till 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon because there were people from the aerospace industry and everybody there that just didn't believe it. Now, I think you had 10 100-watt lights.
Yes, I did.
Plus a 2,500-watt
I had a 600-watt quartz heater and 10 100-watt light bulbs, and I lit all that up with a 500-watt motor. That's all the motor could draw, because it was not a capacitive run motor.
I want you to know, guys, that there were people under the table looking for hidden
wires. Here's the whole thing that the people are going to have to understand is that G-field generator represents one thing. It represents a zero. It's when the iron comes into the magnetic fields, and instead of cutting them, it is just charged. And it becomes neutral to the magnetic field. And when it comes out of the magnetic field, it comes out with one hell of a whomp. And that's the energy that we want to use. That's the energy we want to burn, because the opposite effect happens then. Instead of putting drag on a motor like a normal generator would, it will speed up the motor, because the motor has no load to drive. And the harder the load is to drive, the faster the motor wants to spin. Well, that's backwards to everything that we know.
Does that pretty well go along with what you and Bill, that you and Ray found out in your work?
Very much so, yes.
Exactly, yeah.
As I understood that, I thought, well, now how can we, You see, one of the problems that we had as a group is that we didn't have a machinist or a shop or lathes around that we could manufacture or try to duplicate this kind of a system. And being more involved in electronics than anything else, we said, well, can we do it electronically with only one battery? Apparently, it has been done electronically before, but never quite that way, so...
You didn't go solid state on us, did you?
Essentially, we did, yes. I'm afraid we did.
You get 12 stars. 25 stars.
Well, it wasn't an easy chore. Once we figured out, after we went through a couple of failures there, once we figured out exactly how to design a rather unique type of a voltage doubler, we were doing just fine with a plug. See, we had a plug in the wall that would run our solid states, and our solid states would control the actual charging of the battery and the lighting of the bulbs and whatever. But, of course, it didn't make for a very good demonstration with this thing plugged in the wall, so we decided to make the whole thing self-contained.
Bless your heart.
Well, that's where we ran into trouble, because IC chips do not like scalar. It just doesn't like it.
There's
no matter of fact, I think I had to dig out of
that.
Are those your CMOS chips?
Well, we were using TTL.
Uh-huh. They don't like scalar.
None of it likes scalar. As a matter of fact, I think I had to dig an LED out of the ceiling once. It was rather difficult.
I had a few myself.
Yes. However, we did finally figure out a way to do it, to isolate the integrated circuitry from the scalar effect. And then it became a rather impressive little device, sitting there with nothing but this battery on it, battery bubbling away, charging just fine.
You'll blow up that battery if you're not careful.
If you're not careful. And one of the interesting things that we had is a light bulb blowing. Now,
yes.
I give you a little interesting piece of information here for the technocrats that may be listening.
There are a few, I think.
I'm sure. Let's see, we had a 4 ampere hour moped motorcycle battery.
Yeah, the smallest lead acid battery that we could get.
Yeah, the reason for that being is because any effect that we would obtain would probably be over quickly. We wouldn't have to wait around all day for something to happen. The motorcycle battery only had 4 ampere hours, and if it was going to die, it wouldn't take all day to do it. This was the theory behind it, anyway.
They sure will die quick when the thing won't start and you keep trying to kick it over there.
That's true. And let's see, then we had a four amp light bulb at 12 volts. That's about 48 watts. And we ran the whole thing for 11 hours. Now,
11 hours on a 4 hour battery.
Yeah, well, it didn't stop then. We turned it off.
No,
but you just got tired of that.
No, it was a 1 hour battery.
Oh, it was a 1 hour battery.
Right.
You realize that would have gone on, you know, until something just broke?
Affirmative, it would have. It's a total of 44 ampere hours out of a 4 ampere hour battery and when we shut it off. And then, of course, we thought, well, this thing seems to be working pretty well. Let's charge the battery up conventionally all the way to the top with a conventional charger and see how long, and start this whole thing over, make some real notes, some real scientific records on the thing.
Need some data, you know, to draw some conclusions from.
Right.
So it took us. A very interesting thing occurred. The battery, as far as the hydrometer was concerned, with a small acid, it seemed to tell us that it was discharging. However, the light bulb would still light if you put it right across the battery.
Amazing.
A very interesting thing. It took 16 hours at 2 amps to bring the thing back up to what the hydrometer called 10% charged. Nevertheless,
it's running away.
It runs just beautifully. It's just unbelievable, the thing. Now, one of the demonstrations I gave to some of the technical people in the area was an ammeter in series with the light bulb, digital type, a digital voltmeter across the light bulb, and a Tektronix oscilloscope across the light bulb.
You're getting sophisticated, I'd say.
A little bit. Now, when the thing was detuned, when it wasn't properly operating, the light bulb glowed very, very dimly, and we saw about 2 or 3 volts on the light bulb and about 47 milliamps of current. And the oscilloscope showed us the waveform going to the light bulb at the same voltage level as the digital meter did. And then we bring the thing up into tune it to the battery's resonant frequency, or subharmonic of the battery's resonant frequency, for the people out there that like those things. And when this occurred, the bulb glowed full bright, the voltage went to zero, the scope straight line, and the amperage went to zero.
But the bulb kept on burning.
Right. Very brightly, yes.
That's it, guys.
That's exactly right.
The way it does it.
Now, where was the energy coming from, Bill and Ray?
Well, now that can get complicated. Mr. Pendini certainly knows, and Tom certainly knows, and I think I know.
Well, do you mind if I bring somebody else in on the conversation?
One question here, Bill.
Yeah, go ahead.
So it is absolute proof that we have to have something in front of our eyes to believe it, right?
Oh, there is absolute proof of that.
But in reality, all our instrumentation shows zero, and the light glows.
Right. That's affirmative. The instrumentation is pretty much a linear stuff, and the scalar being nonlinear isn't picked up by the instrumentation.
It goes right through it.
So we've got a lot of work to do on detecting scalar, don't we?
Right. Very much so.
Well, I have on the line another gentleman who is with another one of our rather large organizations who I think may have something to add to this. Do you want to listen to another independent investigator like yourself?
Sure.
All right. We'll bring him home in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind, and we're talking to John Bedini, who's given us free energy, who's given us a whole new way to listen to music, who's given us a whole new way to stay healthy. Tom Bearden is with us, who is working very, very closely with John. He's down in Huntsville, Alabama. We have Bill and Ray, and we'll bring Ron on right after this. Hello, Ron.
Oh, hello, Bill.
You've been listening to all of this?
I sure have, all but the first 20 minutes, and I can blame it on my two friends. I got a bone to pick with them.
All right, you're ready.
John and Tom, since we're giving out stars tonight, I think you got to take two away from these two guys.
Uh-oh, what'd they do now?
They didn't notify me they were going to be on the open line tonight.
Oh.
Can you believe that?
Ron, I thought I did. You have 40 stars, Ron.
Okay, John.
All right, Ron, I don't know whether you want to mention who you're with. But I know that you have, although you and I haven't had a chance to meet yet, been deeply involved in the work of John and Tom. But you're certainly highly qualified to make it a judgment, and you've been working with it. What is your estimation of it all?
Well, I'd like to throw, since the two gentlemen on their last mentioned that...
They're still with us.
Things don't always work the way they're supposed to. They left out one little item that I was discussing with John and Tom a short time ago. Certain types of electrolytic capacitors do not like scalar waves either. They actually explode in just a few seconds of time. And this is not due to overvoltage, overcurrent, or anything else. The chemistry in the electrolyte of certain types of capacitors that are normally used in normal electronic circuits just completely refuse to function in the normal manner when a scalar signal is present. I think John can confirm that, and I know Tom is very much aware of this.
Have you found that out, Bill and Ray?
Well, we haven't experienced that yet.
It goes right through a capacitor.
But there are certain times it will blow up.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the highest grade talons are the worst.
Yeah.
And it's almost dangerous because a person could get hurt. It only takes a few seconds, and they... When they do explode, they explode in a fashion that is not normal to any electrical type explosion, such as anyone knowing the result of a capacitor exploding or blowing up due to overvoltage or whatever the case may be. There's usually a string of tin foil, dielectric stuff that spreads itself all around you when this happens. When there's a scalar potential involved and a capacitor explodes, everything internally within that capacitor, virtually every atom, ignites simultaneously. The end result is that you find there's just fragmentations of dust particles.
You have a little mushroom cloud, right?
Exactly, and it's stuck on everything in the immediate area.
Well, as you know, Ron, if you've been with us for a while, we took a little time in the beginning to talk about some of the awesome side of this science. And, of course, you're looking at it in a very little micro sense with a capacitor blowing up, but you can blow up a great deal more than that. But like any new technology, there is a good side of it, too. And what is thrilling to me is to see people like yourself and Bill and Ray, to on their own, be because the government isn't going to do it. You know, it's they don't know anything about it at MIT or UCLA, and so therefore it doesn't exist. That the genius of the American people are starting to go to work on this new technology, and we're beginning to see this happen all around the world, which is the plea that John has made and that Tom has made for lo these many years here on this radio program. I really commend all of you. I'd like for you to stay on the line and talk to our listeners. They may have just a bunch of questions. You got five guys to talk to who have found themselves knee-deep in scalar interferometry and wonders that this science can bring, unless you, any of you have anything to add before we do that.
Bill, could I mention something about the frustrations? I think her name was Joanne that was on earlier.
Yes.
Tell her she has a lot of company.
Yes.
My wife, for example, says, why can't we do anything? Why does not the government understand? And we went through this even last night. She had read part of a manuscript that Tom had presented, and it really kind of stirred her up in a way. I just want to let Joanne know she's not the only one. There's many other women that know what's going down that haven't made trips to the Ukraine, and they feel the same way that she does. So she's not a lonely person out there in any way.
I have found in conversations with Joanne, although she never did identify herself to me, she would call up and chew me out pretty good from time to time on the news work I was doing or whatever. And she was always on target. And I think she did articulate a feeling that we all feel about the politics of science and how economics seems to run it. And science and the betterment of mankind seems to be way off in the background someplace.
Yes,
very, very sad that is.
Yes, I agree 1,000%.
Okay. We'll go to our callers in just a second. We're speaking with Tom Bearden and John Bedini. John here in the studio with us. We have Bill and Ray who have taken this science and in their own way, and they're with one of our larger corporations, have shown that it works. And we also have Ron on the line who is with a very large corporation too, who's working very closely with it. And Ron, it works, right?
Absolutely.
Do you know
Absolutely.
Where that energy comes from?
No. Yes and no.
Yes, sir. You got some theories. Okay.
Well, we know and we don't know. That you give me a trick question. You ought to shoot that one over to Tom.
I'll shoot a little bit at you in a few minutes, Ron.
Okay.
About where I think it's coming from.
All right.
All right, John.
So, to get in on this, we have a lot of people from a lot of sections of science that are dealing with it, and they can answer your questions. You know, I can give you words. These guys have got their fingers in that pie all of the time. I'll be right back in a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins on KABC Talk Radio 7, although they are now beginning to listen. Ignored by our great citadels of learning and great corporations, they won't have anything to do with it, but yet in it is the promise of a world that is unbelievable. So what has been happening here is that individuals, the Americans, to heck with all of the other institutions, the Americans themselves are getting out there, digging out the new information, digging out the new experiments, digging out the new science. And I guess one of these days, the people are going to say to the government, do something about this, rather than all of the foolish things that they deal with for the most of the time. I'm proud of all of you. Are you ready to take some callers, gentlemen? Okay.
Okay.
Here we go. I believe we have Joe on the line. Hello, Joe.
Hello. Good evening. I'm absolutely delighted as a metaphysician, full-time professional, that new science is finally catching up and proving old metaphysics.
It doesn't it?
Yeah. To talk about zero, that's something that the Kabbalists and metaphysicians have been talking about for ages, that God, spirit, or whatever you want to call it, is everything, all, one, and nothing. The computers operate on one and zero. Zero is very comprehensible to me. That's not why I originally called. I originally called because of a confusion between my metaphysics and my 60s paranoia regarding what happened in Russia. I have felt for some years now, for a couple of years, that the Russians misusing, being spiritless and purely materialistic, misusing those powers, would have some kind of negative feedback. And yet, what's happened lately, four of our NASA flights have blown up in a row. And I'm wondering if there is a secret war going on. Like, we can do this to you, and we can, if you do this, then we'll do this to you. I'm wondering if it's metaphysical feedback and negative use or if there is some kind of a war going on.
Very perceptive of you. I go for the latter.
Yeah, I do too. I'm sure that there has been a lot of mismanagement at NASA, and probably in Russia too, and there's some bureaucrats who couldn't fess up to their inability to deal with the explosion in Russia, taking into consideration the mentality that we're dealing with. But it's quite possible that one of our lasers could have done that also.
I know that.
Yeah, Russia has been pouring lots of money into what we do here against the law in many areas, which is psychic development and
don't
psychic
exploration.
Don't get
Joanne upset. Call them the Soviets, though.
All right, yeah, right, the Soviets. And working in new ways of healing people, working with crystals. We don't get any support here at all. I mean, I know that what I'm doing now is legal in the state of California, according to Supreme Court decision of last August. But there are still forces, like in Long Beach, which are against us and fighting us.
Talking about the ordinance down there where they want to ban anything that...
Well, they want to put us in the red light district, along where I guess their own politicians belong, are making us pay huge sums of money in order to practice what is really free speech, according to Supreme Court.
Well, we're talking about the psychics and all of those things that work down in Long Beach.
That's a whole other subject, but I really feel that Russia's misuse of what may eventually be purely science, what we metaphysicians have kept alive for many years, quietly, secretly.
I want to make just one real quick comment for the benefit of Joanne and anybody else who is concerned about the dams that she was talking about. There was, for a long time, real serious consideration being given in the Soviet Union to damming and diverting the Ob and Denisov rivers, and this was especially, it came to a peak in the late 70s, but I think it was 1981 they finally decided to shelve that project because ecological concerns had been raised inside the country, so that they did not go forward with that the particular project that she was referring to, fortunately. Now, I was very intensely involved with what Tom Bearden was discussing, and I guess that's probably all I'm going to have time to get into tonight. First of all, you brought up something which you referred to as electrogravitational waves.
That's what a state of wave is.
Yeah, that's the first time that I've heard you refer to it with that nomenclature, and I'm wondering, is that your term, or has it been characterized by anybody else?
Well, in the 60s, as you know, a lot of people were calling it electrogravitics. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to get at it, but they never got into the zero approach. And so they were trying to really bombard things with a lot of very high voltages and things like that. Mm-hmm. Some of the research there went classified and then later seemed to just sort of died out. But they called it electrogravitics. It came to be the thing that they called it. And so rather than revive that term, which had just fallen into disrepute, I use the term electrogravitation, because what you're really doing is you're tying electromagnetism and gravitation together like Kaluza did in his theory.
I'm not familiar with Kaluza.
Okay, Kaluza unified electromagnetics and gravitation in 1921. His paper was recommended for publication by Einstein. And what he did is he added one more dimension, so a spatial dimension, so that you had four spatial dimensions and one time dimension. Mm-hmm. And in this five-dimensional model, you didn't have a separate electromagnetics and a separate gravitation. You just had gravitation, but it was five-dimensional gravitation. And what we see as electromagnetics, the electromagnetic force fields, are the bleed-off of a five-dimensional gravitational potential in the fifth dimension. In other words, look at it like to put it in country boy language, you've got this crazy pressure in five dimensions, or stress, that we call a five-dimensional gravity potential, and it always loves to bleed off in electromagnetics in the fifth dimension. It slides around our world so that we see it as photons and electromagnetic energy. But if you block that slide so it can't slide around that way, you force it to bleed off into the other dimensions, the other three dimensions. In other words, it becomes normal gravitational energy at that point. And to show you the kind of amplification you can get, between two electrons, the electric field is normally on the order of 10 to the 42 times as strong as the gravitational field. So the stress between them, the 5G gravity potential, is almost all bleeding off as electric field. Very little of it is bleeding off as gravitational attraction between the two. Now, if you were able to go into that, between those two electrons, and block that bleed off in the fifth dimension and cause it all to bleed off as gravity, then the gravitational attraction between those two electrons would go up on the order of 10 to the 42 times as strong as it is now. Well, in normal circuits, you aren't going to get the full thing, of course, but if, my goodness, if you got a millionth of a percent, you know, effect, you would have enormous amplification. And that's why the scalar electromagnetics offers such a tremendous potential, because that's exactly what you do. When you oppose two force fields, putting it in the Calusa type of model, one of those force fields represents a bleed off in one direction, a bleed out of the potential. The other represents a bleed back in. And so the potential is not able to decrease by blowing out in the fifth dimension. You force it to blow out in the four dimensions, the normal, everyday, ordinary world, as gravitational energy. And so you have just, when you make a zero, which is what you do when you sum those two together like that, the electromagnetics, what you've really done is turned it into gravitational field energy. And you've got yourself a real nice amplification factor if you get it doing it very well. You get a pretty good zero.
Did you understand that, Greg?
Yeah, I followed that.
You get five stars.
I'm curious, now, how does this relate to the way we understand, for instance, the way the sun produces its energy through nuclear fusion, and we see, you know, the equation E equals mc squared, the mass is being converted to energy. Wouldn't there be a discrepancy if there's also scalar energy being produced?
No, because normally we don't go around doing that. We only measure half of everything anyway. I'm glad you brought the question up, because it's something I want to say on this program. Take Newton's law. Every action is often equal reaction. Okay? What that really says is you have a system of something, a particle or whatever. You bring in a system of something else, could even be a photon, and you work on that system. Well, the system works back on you. So if you're expending energy on that system, it's expending the identical amount of energy back on you. And that's true even in statics, because if we believe quantum mechanics, there isn't anything static. There's something working like mad in the vacuum anytime you have a static force, a so-called static force in the macro world. So if you look at those two forces while Newton's law applies, while you're working on a system and it's working back on you, if you immediately draw a circle around that, you have a vector zero. And that is an artificial potential. It's like a pressure in a gas, you know, where the molecules are going every which way. But you can use that pressure in any direction. You can bleed it off in any direction. So if you grab that thing, John was calling this capturing the surface charge, and that's the way he made that first motor. If you capture that moment when that opposition is going on, it does occur in a finite time. It cannot occur just instantly and be gone. It can occur very fast, but it is finite. If you capture that thing as a potential, you can bleed it off in any direction, you can use it, and guess what? You've got at least twice the energy in there. Even in considering the vacuum to stay linear, you still have twice the energy in there that you had in the amount you were putting in. So if you believe Newton's third law and you believe quantum mechanics, and you will use the artificial potential approach, you can always get more energy out than you put in anyway. T. Henry Murray said, if you really understood what back EMF was and you captured and used it, you could do what I'm doing. And John was calling it capturing the surface charge. John was hitting
the
back.
Hey, Tom, we're about to lose your back EMF. Could you speak up just a little bit there?
Yes, I think our phone is acting up. I'm speaking right in the phone.
Okay.
John was hitting the battery, and in that very instant that he hit the battery, and before the ions that in the battery that were being opposed by the spike, before they could slow down, they kept bearing forward. You had two forces opposing each other electromagnetically, and the momentum of the ions carrying it on in and squeezing that pressure even higher.
And then you reach in, John would switch in and capture that pressure and apply it to the coil, which charged instantly. By the way, a coil never charges with magnetic field. That's nonsense.
Right.
It charges with gravitational field. When it discharges its magnetic field, it charges its gravitational field. You're still in five dimensions. And then if you let it discharge in a normal fashion, you get normal old garden variety magnetic field, and that drives your motor. That's the secret of that first motor. And I have John's permission to say this on the air.
That's right.
I'm saying it.
Tom?
Yes.
Also, you know, since these two guys tonight have shared this information, and also Ron, I'm going to make available those tapes on all the motors I worked on.
Beautiful.
Which do show conventional measurements.
They've been highly classified until now.
Well, but now's the time. There's only so much time, Tom, left in which our society has to pull itself out of its hole.
That's fine, John. Set a nominal price on them so you can continue.
That's right. Now, there's a lot of research work in these things, and there's a lot of research in making this technology available, but I don't want to keep it back from the people.
That's right.
Well, if somebody wants those tapes, which you have let me be privy to, they are fascinating.
They're going to get them from Bedini Electronics at our P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 769. San Fernando, California, 91341. And our phone number is area code 818-367-7762. And we'll make the tuners available to the people. We'll make the interferometers available to the people at a very reasonable price so that they can get into this and try to understand what we're doing.
What we're doing, I think, is one of the most significant things in the world because we're seeing a grassroots movement in science.
Well, it's about,
rather than leaving it up to the politicians and the large universities and corporations, and hopefully they'll drag themselves along one of these days.
But, of course, also, Tom, I think you're in agreement with this, Ron Cole has done numerous amounts of work on these motors.
Yes, indeed.
All right, and Ron has proven, without a shadow of a doubt, a little bitty generator driving a motor five times its size.
That's correct.
And speeding up while doing it.
That's Did you correct. Do that, Ron? Are you still there, Ron?
Oh,
Ron, you're there. I just didn't have you punched in. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, I'm here now.
You
yes,
didn't.
I have done what John mentioned.
But tell him, Ron. Tell him about the little bitty wires. And you see, I want to throw this into the program because the motor that they are looking at is what our science calls believing.
Okay, well, let me give an explanation of the itty-bitty wires, as you mentioned.
Can you hold on that explanation, Ron?
Yes, I can.
You understand this as much as anybody, but I have to take a little break here before we get to the itty-bitty wires, smaller than your hair, that shouldn't do what they're doing.
All right.
Isn't that true?
Yes, that's true.
All right, hang in there. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind on KABC. There's here.
Okay, I try to give an illustration of this in a somewhat simplex form so some listeners can understand. In electrical flow, basic circuits based on conventional engineering design, current and voltage oppose each other. They flow in virtually opposite directions. This goes back to part of Steinmetz's basic engineering book still taught in the college today by Mr. Cook and so on and so forth. Point being that the voltage is equivalent to the value or quantity of what is to be used, such as water. Current is how much water do you have? What is the mass of the water? Okay. Well, in electrical circuit, these two factors end up trying to oppose each other. So when you need a greater flow of water in electricity, we would call it a greater flow of current. The wire has to be larger. Otherwise, the tremendous heating will take place due to the restriction of a small wire, or we could call it water-wise, a small pipe. And if you try to force umpteen gallons of water through a tiny pipe, there has to be a tremendous force on the other end to push it through the tiny pipe. If it's a large pipe, it takes very little force to push the same amount of displacement of water through a given time period. Okay, now, when I get into a scalar signal that's sent down a wire, voltage and current flow in the same direction simultaneously. They're coherent with each other. Okay, if you're flowing at the speed of light, coherently in the same direction, there's no way heating can be created. A wire can be the size of a person's human hair.
It usually is, don't it?
Exactly. Now, you can, your whole house could be wired up with number 40 wire rather than number 12.
If you could find it.
Exactly.
And Ron, tell him if you touch the two wires together, the machine just speeds away, right?
Exactly.
And you can hold those naked wires and nothing happens to your fingers.
So no little kid could stick his finger in the socket and get killed.
Exactly. Now, let me explain something. Approximately a little over a year ago, about a year and a half ago now, I was in John's lab over there, and he had fired off a 1,500-watt load with two pieces of number 42 wire off his generator.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I thought he was firing it off with one piece of wire. The other one was laying on a little piece of carpet. I couldn't see it because it wasn't too well lit at the time.
It's very small, smaller than your hair.
And he said, put your hand on this one, the one I could see, and I did. And I couldn't believe it. There's no way you can carry 1,500 watts through a piece of number 42 wire. And these wires were at least 3 to 4 feet long. And here was a quartz heating element blowing full bore. So John says, let me show you this one. And so he takes the two little wires off the end of the generator, connects them onto a normal AC plug, plugs them into a normal receptacle from the Edison Company or whoever, and they immediately accelerated themselves. Okay.
Bad electricity.
Now, does that tell you what scary is? Something is traveling in the same direction at an infinite velocity. Does not need a big pipe. Does that make sense?
Greg, did that help you?
Well, actually, it got a little bit off the subject. Could I try to get a brief answer from Tom on what I had read?
Okay, go ahead.
Ask him to repeat the question.
Repeat it again.
Yeah, right? I will. I was very interested in what was just being discussed, but you had referred to the fact that the sun itself, or any star for that matter, of course, is in fact generating scalar energy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how this relates to the way we normally understand the production of energy by a stellar object. It
spins our planet, Craig.
Excuse me?
It spins our planet around.
You got 30 seconds to answer the question.
What I'm saying is, you know, we usually explain in terms of nuclear fusion with the E equals MC squared and the energies deriving from mass. Now, is there a discrepancy here?
No, it fuels all of that. In addition, but it does produce heat completely separately from that. But it certainly fuels all the radioactivity and everything else. It's in equilibrium.
Is there conversion of mass into energy?
Yes, there's no problem with that. In fact, you can go one step further. By energy, if you mean ordinary electromagnetic energy, you can go further into gravitational field energy, in which case it's really scalar electromagnetic.
You know what, Tom? We're going to have to go one step further at another time. We just ran out of it. Craig, I'm sorry. I wish we'd got to you earlier. Your questions are always very penetrating, and I appreciate you hanging on the line as long as you did. And Bill and Ray, thank you so much for the research that you've done to show that this is happening. And Ron Cole, you too. How very nice that you guys are getting behind John Bedini and Tom Bearden with what they're doing. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's run-through of Weather Wars Update and a look at the new world that we'll live in, and it's the world of the scalar. We'll see you next week. I'm Bill Jenkins.